Chapter 15. I told him almost in a whisper, for he attuned my communications to his minor key, that we had such a thing as a pony, and I hinted, as gently as I could, that he was confoundedly in the way too. I was very anxious to have him landed, before I began to handle the cargo. Almayer remained looking up at me for a long while with incredulous and melancholy eyes, as though it were not a safe thing to believe my statement. This pathetic mistrust in the favorable issue of any sort of affair touched me deeply, and I added, "He doesn't seem a bit the worse for the passage. He's a nice pony too." Almayer was not to be cheered up. For all answer he cleared his throat, and looked down again at his feet. I tried to close with him on another tack. "By Jove," I said, "aren't you afraid of catching pneumonia or bronchitis or something, walking about in a singlet in such a wet fog?" He was not to be propitiated by a show of interest in his health. His answer was a sinister "oh fear," as much as to say that even that way of escape from inclement fortune was closed to him. "I just came down," Dotty mumbled after a while. "Well then, now you're here I will land that pony for you at once, and you can lead him home. I really don't want him on deck. He's in the way." Almayer seemed doubtful. I insisted. "Why, I will just swing him out, and land him on the wharf right in front of you. I'd much rather do it before the hatches are off. The little devil may jump down the hold, or do some other deadly thing." "There's a halter?" postulated Almayer. "Yes, of course there's a halter." And without waiting any more I leaned over the bridge rail. "Sarang, land to an Almayer's pony." The cook hastened to shut the door of the galley, and a moment later a great scuffle began on deck. The pony kicked with extreme energy, the calashes skipped out of the way, the Sarang issued many orders in a cracked voice. Suddenly the pony leaped upon the fore hatch. His little hoofs thundered tremendously. He plunged and reared. He had tossed his mane and his forelock into a state of amazing wildness. He dilated his nostrils. Bits of foam flecked his broad little chest. His eyes blazed. He was something under 11 hands. He was fierce, terrible, angry, warlike. He said, "Ha, ha." Distinctly, he raged and thumped, and 16 able-bodied calashes stood round him like disconcerted nurses round a spoilt and passionate child. He whisked his tail incessantly. He arched his pretty neck. He was perfectly delightful. He was charmingly naughty. There was not an atom of vice in that performance. No savage baring of teeth and lying back of ears. On the contrary, he pricked them forward in a comically aggressive manner. He was totally unmoral and lovable. I would have liked to give him bread, sugar, carrots. But life is a stern thing, and the sense of duty the only safe guide. So I steeled my heart, and from my elevated position on the bridge I ordered the men to fling themselves upon him in a body. The elderly Sarang, emitting a strange inarticulate cry, gave the example. He was an excellent petty officer, very competent indeed, and a moderate opium smoker. The rest of them in one great rush smothered that pony. They hung on to his ears, to his mane, to his tail. They lay in piles across his back, 17 in all. The carpenter, seizing the hook of the cargo chain, flung himself on top of them. A very satisfactory petty officer too, but he stuttered. "Have you ever heard a light yellow, lean, sad earnest Chinaman stutter in pidgin English? It's very weird indeed." He made the 18th. I could not see the pony at all, but from the swaying and heaving of that heap of men I knew that there was something alive inside. From the wharf Almayer hailed in quavering tones. "Oh, I say." Where he stood he could not see what was going on deck, unless perhaps the tops of the men's heads. He could only hear the scuffle, the mighty thuds, as if the ship were being knocked to pieces. I looked over. "Had it? Don't let them break his legs," he entreated me plaintively. "Oh, nonsense. He's all right now. He can't move. By that time, the cargo chain had been hooked to the broad canvas belt around the pony's body. The calashes sprang off simultaneously in all directions, rolling over each other, and the worthy Serang, making a dash behind the winch, turned the steam on. "Steady!" I yelled, in great apprehension of seeing the animal snatched up to the very head of the derrick. On the wharf, Almayer shuffled his straw slippers uneasily. The rattle of the winch stopped, and in a tense, impressive silence that pony began to swing across the deck. How limp he was! Directly he felt himself in the air, he relaxed every muscle in a most wonderful manner. His four hoofs knocked together in a bunch, his head hung down, and his tail remained pendant in a nerveless and absolute immobility. He reminded me vividly of the pathetic little sheep which hangs on the collar of the Order of the Golden Fleece. I had no idea that anything in the shape of a horse could be so limp as that, either living or dead. His wild mane hung down lumpily, a mere mass of inanimate horsehair. His aggressive ears had collapsed, but as he went swaying slowly across the front of the bridge, I noticed an astute gleam in his dreamy, half-closed eye. A trustworthy quartermaster, his glance anxious and his mouth on the broad grin, was easing over the derrick watchfully. I superintended, greatly interested. "So, that will do." The derrick had stopped. The calashes lined the rail. The rope of the halter hung perpendicular and motionless like a bell pull in front of Almayer. Everything was very still. I suggested amicably that he should catch hold of the rope and mind what he was about. He extended a provokingly casual and superior hand. "Look out then. Lower away." Almayer gathered in the rope intelligently enough, but when the pony's hoofs touched the wharf he gave way all at once to a most foolish optimism. Without pausing, without thinking, almost without looking, he disengaged the hook suddenly from the sling, and the cargo chain, after hitting the pony's quarters, swung back against the ship's side with a noisy, rattling slap. I suppose I must have blinked. I know I missed something, because the next thing I saw was Almayer lying flat on his back on the jetty. He was alone. Astonishment deprived me of speech long enough to give Almayer time to pick himself up in a leisurely and painful manner. The calashes lining the rail had all their mouths open. The mist flew in the light breeze, and it had come over quite thick enough to hide the shore completely. "How on earth did you manage to let him get away?" I asked, scandalized. Almayer looked into the smarting palm of his right hand, but did not answer my inquiry. "Where do you think he will get to?" I cried. "Are there any fences anywhere in this fog? Can he bolt into the forest? What's to be done now?" Almayer shrugged his shoulders. "Some of my men are sure to be about. They will get hold of him sooner or later." "Sooner or later? That's all very fine, but what about my canvas sling? He's carried it off. I want it now, at once, to land two Celeb's cows. Since Dongola, we had on board a pair of the pretty little island cattle in addition to the pony. Tied up on the other side of the foredeck, they had been whisking their tails into the other door of the galley. These cows were not for Almayer, however. They were in vest to Abdullah bin Selim, his enemy. Almayer's disregard of my requisites was complete. "If I were you, I would try to find out where he's gone," I insisted. "Ad, you better call your men together or something. He will throw himself down and cut his knees. He may even break a leg, you know." But Almayer, plunged in abstracted thought, did not seem to want that pony anymore. Amazed at this sudden indifference, I turned all hands out on shore to hunt for him on my own account, or, at any rate, to hunt for the canvas sling which he had round his body. The whole crew of the steamer, with the exception of firemen and engineers, rushed up the jetty past the thoughtful Almayer and vanished from my sight. The white fog swallowed them up, and again there was a deep silence that seemed to extend for miles up and down the stream. Still taciturn, Almayer started to climb on board, and I went down from the bridge to meet him on the after deck. Would you mind telling the captain that I want to see him very particularly? He asked me in a low tone, letting his eyes stray all over the place. Very well. I will go and see. With the door of his cabin wide open, Captain C, just back from the bathroom, big and broad-chested, was brushing his thick, damp, iron-gray hair with two large brushes. Mr. Almayer told me he wanted to see you very particularly, sir. Saying these words, I smiled. I don't know why I smiled, except that it seemed absolutely impossible to mention Almayer's name without a smile of a sort. It had not to be necessarily a mirthful smile. Turning his head towards me, Captain C smiled too, rather joyously. The pony got away from him, eh? Yes, sir. He did. Where is he? Goodness only knows. No. I mean Almayer. Let him come along. The captain's stateroom opening straight on deck under the bridge, I had only to beckon from the doorway to Almayer, who had remained aft, with downcast eyes, on the very spot where I had left him. He strolled up moodily, shook hands, and at once asked permission to shut the cabin door. I have a pretty story to tell you, were the last words I heard. The bitterness of tone was remarkable. I went away from the door, of course. For the moment I had no crew on board, only the Chinaman carpenter, with a canvas bag hung round his neck and a hammer in his hand, roamed about the empty decks knocking out the wedges of the hatches and dropping them into the bag conscientiously. Having nothing to do, I joined our two engineers at the door of the engine room. It was near breakfast time. He's turned up early, hasn't he? Commented the second engineer, and smiled indifferently. He was an abstemious man with a good digestion and a placid, reasonable view of life even when hungry. Yes, I said. Hut up with the old man. Some very particular business. He will spin him a damned endless yarn, observed the chief engineer. He smiled rather sourly. He was dyspeptic, and suffered from gnawing hunger in the morning. The second smiled broadly, a smile that made two vertical folds on his shaven cheeks. And I smiled too, but I was not exactly amused. And that man, whose name apparently could not be uttered anywhere in the Malay archipelago without a smile, there was nothing amusing whatever. That morning he breakfasted with us silently, looking mostly into his cup. I informed him that my men came upon his pony capering in the fog on the very brink of the 8-foot-deep well in which he kept his store of gutta. The cover was off with no one nearby, and the whole of my crew just missed going heels over head into that beastly hole. Juramadi Item, our best quartermaster, deft at fine needlework, he who mended the ship's flax and sewed buttons on our coats, was disabled by a kick on the shoulder. Both remorse and gratitude seemed foreign to Almayer's character. He mumbled. Do you mean that pirate fellow? What pirate fellow? The man has been in the ship 11 years, I said indignantly. It's his looks, Almayer muttered for all apology. The sun had eaten up the fog. From where we sat under the after awning, we could see in the distance the pony tied up in front of Almayer's house, to a post of the veranda. We were silent for a long time. All at once Almayer, alluding evidently to the subject of his conversation in the captain's cabin, exclaimed anxiously across the table. I really don't know what I can do now. Captain C only raised his eyebrows at him, and got up from his chair. We dispersed to our duties, but Almayer, half-dressed as he was in his cretin pajamas and the thin cotton singlet, remained on board, lingering near the gangway, as though he could not make up his mind whether to go home or stay with us for good. Our Chinaman boys gave him side glances as they went to and fro, and Da Singh, our young chief steward, the handsomest and most sympathetic of Chinamen, catching my eye, nodded knowingly at his burly back. In the course of the morning I approached him for a moment. Well, Mr. Almayer, I addressed him easily, you haven't started on your letters yet. We had brought him his mail, and he had held the bundle in his hand ever since we got up from breakfast. He glanced at it when I spoke, and, For a moment, it looked as if he were on the point of opening his fingers and letting the whole lot fall overboard. I believe he was tempted to do so. I shall never forget that man afraid of his letters. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.